Welcome to the Parrot Unbound, Portsmouth Public Library's podcast. I'm Grace, the Community Relations page and podcast editor. This episode features the uncut audio from the 2019 Space at PPL program, a discussion about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence with St. Anselm professors Nicole Gugliucci, physics, and Joshua Tepley, philosophy. Tepley began the session with a question.
Let's already make it interactive. Does anyone here know the difference between science and philosophy? So scientists and philosophers both ask these big questions. So then how is philosophy different from science? What do you think?
We don't have answers.
Who, the scientists or the philosophers?
Philosophers.
The philosophers don't have answers. How do you think philosophers feel when they hear that kind of an answer to that question? We don't have answers, or there are no answers to philosophical questions, or we don't know the answers? What do you think? So students often say this. They say, well, philosophers, you know, you can't answer any questions in philosophy. But I mean, if that's true, then philosophy classes are a waste of time. But suppose in a philosophy class we talk about the soul, okay? And so I might define what a soul is. Am I going to hand that over to Nicole and have Nicole determine if there are souls? Or if God exists? So is that the scientists to prove there's a God or not? Well, so what do you think? What does that have to do with, you think? Yeah, please.
Well, in the 16th century, they called science philosophy.
That's true. It was
always called philosophy, and then it became science.
That's true.
It separated itself off because of the methodology that they used.
Right. So what's the method that scientists use? What's it called?
The scientific method.
Right. Yeah, or the empirical method, right? So scientists answer their questions empirically. Mm-hmm. They perform experiments or make observations. Is that right?
That's perfect.
And so if
it's, I mean,
if
we don't do a lot of experiments in astronomy. We can't blow stars up, but we do lots
make
of
observations, right?
Yes.
So if your question can be answered empirically, by making observations or performing experiments, then it's science. If not, then it probably is philosophy. So here are some examples of relevant scientific questions. How many planets are there that have life-supporting atmospheres in our galaxy or in our solar system? How many planets are there in our galaxy? What's the origin of life? How did life evolve on Earth? Could Mars support life? Those are all questions for scientists. So in my classes, if a student asks me one of those questions, I say, well, I'm not an expert, go talk to Nicole. Philosophical questions would include things like, well, does it matter if there are aliens? Like, would that have profound consequences? Would it have any ethical consequences? Should we care if there are aliens? Should we spend any money looking for aliens? That's the first thing to get clear on, is that some questions we ask tonight will be scientific, and then Nicole is the expert. Some are more philosophical, and then, I mean, I guess I'm more the expert.
You are the expert.
Okay, so that's the one thing I want us to keep in mind, okay?
Excellent, thank you. I wanted to cover a few of the questions that we're going to be talking about, starting with the more scientific ones and straying off to the more philosophical ones, but not just philosophical ones, as you'll see in a sec. So there's actually a really fun way to quantify the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And if you've ever heard of the Drake equation, it's an equation that you can use to calculate the number of civilizations that we expect will detect looking for intelligent life in our galaxy. I say galaxy instead of universe because once you start getting really big, really distant, it becomes unwieldy. So we kind of tend to stick within the galaxy when we talk about this question. Now, you may realize we don't know the answer to this, obviously. We don't even know all the factors that go into it. As an equation, as a mathematical equation, it's kind of terrible. But it's useful as I use it as my syllabus. But this was actually created in 1960 by Frank Drake as the itinerary for the first conference on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because physicists apparently can't just write a regular itinerary, they make an equation. So I'm going to go through what these different symbols mean. So we're talking about how many civilizations can we detect? That's the number N. That depends on these seven factors. First one, we know pretty well. It's the rate of star formation in the galaxy. So stars, very generally, are made from clouds of gas that collapse, as this simulation is showing, under gravitational pressure. And with things like cooling, magnetic fields can get in the way, interstellar winds can get in the way, it's all kinds of weird stuff. It's actually a really complex topic in itself, but generally you have these gas clouds that collapse. And the Milky Way, on average, creates one solar mass per year of stars. So one sun-sized star per year. That was known fairly well at the time that Drake wrote down that equation. That's the only thing that was known when Drake wrote down this equation. The next factor was not well known even when I was in college. It wasn't until the last couple of decades we've got a really good handle on the fraction of stars in our Milky Way that have planets. At last time I checked, like 2 weeks ago, the number of confirmed exoplanets that have been detected is around 4,000, a little over 4,000. There's a number of thousands more candidates that haven't been confirmed yet. But using the statistics based on what we've detected so far, it's estimated there's about 100 billion planets in the Milky Way. Milky Way has 100 billion stars, so it's like a 1-to-1 ratio. There's a lot of planetary surfaces out there. After that, things start to get hard. How many planets in each system are habitable? This brings us to the question is, what does it even mean to be habitable? Generally, we like to look for planets in what's known as the Goldilocks zone. It's not too close to its star, so it's not too hot. It's not too far from its star, so it's not too cold. It's just at the right temperature for liquid water to exist on the surface, which you may notice already introduces a constraint, already introduces an assumption that life needs water. So this is the part where we can talk about this scientifically, but we realize we're already starting to make assumptions about what we're looking for. So is the planet, how many planets are habitable? What fraction of those habitable planets does life arise? Hey, we've got one example of a planet with life. It's not super great for looking at statistics of how things work. But we can look at our planet and say, it was only a few hundred million years after the planet was being bombarded constantly with rocks from space that little tiny life forms formed. So this is a cyanobacterium from 3.5 billion years ago. So once, since we're talking about communicating with extraterrestrials, the next thing we need to know is how many, what fraction of those life-bearing planets has an intelligent species come about? And then this leads us to the definition of what is an intelligent species? What is sentience? This is something where we've strayed, we've left astronomy completely, we've left my area of expertise completely. We're getting into more biology, psychology, sociology, and looking at the nature of intelligence. And I include a picture of a dolphin in there because dolphins are very, very smart creatures. And there's this question of whether or not they are considered sentient, right? So it depends on that kind of definition. The last two factors that we have to consider are not scientific at all, I think. Asking what fraction of those intelligent civilizations have actually bothered to try to communicate, and then, of course, bothered to try to communicate using the methods that we communicate. This is the Tattle Telescope. It's an 85-foot telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, that, as you can tell, I kind of like radio telescopes. Did get a tattoo. I spent a lot of time in West Virginia as a grad student at this particular observatory. This was the first telescope that was used for SETI experiments, and it still stands today. Frank Drake stuck a specific receiver on it, pointed it at a few sun-like stars, and then they repeated the experiment 50 years later for a BBC documentary, and I don't know if it ever came out, but it was very fun to hang out in the back of the control room and watch that happen. So that's asking, all right, why, you know, would they communicate or do they communicate? The last factor, since we started with a rate, stars per year, we have to multiply it by a time frame to get a number of civilizations that we could contact. That time frame is the lifetime of the civilization. And as I'm showing, there are many, many things that could go wrong for a civilization before they get to the point where they're communicating across the galaxy or traveling across the galaxy. This is kind of the depressing part, because we can talk about ways that civilizations can destroy themselves or not prevent destruction from asteroids and all kinds of fun things like that. Later on, Frank Drake considered this to be probably the most important factor, because you can play with all the other numbers you want, but if we don't line up in time with another intelligent civilization that we want to talk to, then there's not going to be much point in searching the skies. The universe has been around for about, just to give you a sense of scale, the universe has been around for about 13.7 billion years. Planets have probably been around for 10 billion years. Ours has been around for 4.5. Humanity has been searching for extraterrestrials for 59 years. So it's a teeny, teeny little fraction of time. Not to mention the whole sum of human history is several thousand years, right? Homo sapiens, now I'm reaching way back into my brain. It's tens of thousands of years.
300,000.
Thank you, 300,000 years. So yeah, we're a tiny, tiny sliver. One way you can think about it is if both my arms are stretched out, all 5'1" of me, if one fingertip was the beginning of the universe, all of human history would fit on like the white part of my nail all the way over here if it didn't have a space nail wrap on it. So if you had that timeline of the universe, we barely make up the like moon of my fingernail. So that actually becomes one of the biggest factors in talking about it. So I think that gives kind of an overview of what we know and what we seek to know and what questions are outstanding. As you see, there's a lot of questions outstanding, and I think it's really fun just to talk about all of these things, particularly what we know, what we don't know.
I have some questions for the audience, but I have a question for you. So you gave a similar, a longer presentation for philosophy colloquium at the college, and then in today too, you said that the equation is, I forget which word you used, but it's terrible or not very good.
It
seems like a great equation to me, so what's wrong with it?
The equation's fine. It's the fact that the factors are so fuzzy and we don't know the numbers to put in.
No, fine, but besides that, I mean, it makes sense, right? The different factors.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it makes sense to me, but a lot of folks who want it to be really more strict and empirical are not happy with it.
Okay, fine. So let's open it up. So I have a question for you right away. So suppose that we discovered that there were extraterrestrial intelligences out there. Tomorrow we get, you know, on the newspapers we read that we've received a signal from another planet. How profound would that be? Would that be a big deal or not? What do you think? I mean, a lot of scientists think there are aliens out there. We don't have any evidence yet. But suppose that we discovered a signal, and the signal is just, let's say, the numbers of pi or whatever, every prime number up to 1,000 and then repeating. Would that ask, how profound would that be?
It depends on what's in the communication.
No, suppose that, so...
Good call.
The initial signal obviously would probably be very basic, right? Something like something that we know is not just noise from a star. So things you're looking for, what? So the prime numbers repeating, or what are you looking for?
Yeah, so SETI searches are looking for things that, like you said, are non-repeating. It's kind of a very vague sense that it's not something that could be explained by a natural phenomenon. There's been a couple of radio signals that have been found that seemed promising. One of them turned out to be pulsars, the anniversary of the discovery of pulsars, these stars that are like lighthouses. They have this bright spot and they spin around and they're really bright. So it goes boop, 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 if you look at a chart of it in the radio. The first question, I think they put LGM question mark, meaning little green men question mark, when they discovered it. Turns out it's a perfectly natural phenomenon. But something that can't be explained, and I think the prime numbers is a great example, because that's something that we think, at least numbers, are something that could be universally understood, and it's really, really, really small chance that a pulsar or something natural is going to be spitting out a sequence of prime numbers.
Yeah. So we get a signal that's the prime numbers. There's not a message that says that God exists or that we love you. It's just prime numbers. Would that be a big deal? What do you think? Yeah, please go ahead.
I actually have a question. We transmit out into space, hoping someone will hear us. What do we transmit?
So the question is asking what we transmit out into space.
We don't transmit, do we? That's very dangerous.
We do all the time.
No, but not on purpose. I mean, so we send out TV.
A few times we have.
But that's dumb, right?
I don't know. I don't agree with Stephen Hawking.
That's one of my questions. Like, should we be transmitting? And to me, it seems really dangerous, right?
So
we're like sending out an invitation to come invade us.
We accidentally transmit all the time, although, and so ever since we've been putting out television radio broadcasts, we've been leaking that particular radio signal out. So if it's been, I don't know, 70 years since strong enough signals have been going, then 70 light years away is where that shell of, you can imagine like this expanding shell of a signal
The TV signals aren't strong enough to go out 70 light years.
It depends on the receiving equipment. So you can make estimates on how far, how much power you would need to transmit a certain distance.
But at some point, isn't it just get like, sort of fizzle out, and it gets there's like this background radiation that gets in the way, and
So
probably nobody could hear us more than say a few light years away.
Unless they were buzzing by in their intergalactic spaceship.
Sure.
Yes. But these are, just wanted to point out there have been a couple times where we sent messages and tried to encode messages that we think would be understandable to another intelligent civilization. I think they used Arecibo. I think they used the Arecibo dish and radar to do that once for funsies.
So what do they transmit?
They estimate our signals would carry.
What's that?
How far did they estimate our signals would carry that have been sent deliberately for this purpose?
Again, it depends on the couple things. The medium that it goes through, if it's going through the plane of the galaxy where most of the planets are, it might get scattered and by the intervening electrons in the way, in which case it may not be interpretable, I don't know.
But the signals they sent out, how far do they expect them to go?
Yeah, I don't know. It totally depends on the direction, the assumptions about their receivers and things like that. So probably wouldn't even make it halfway across the galaxy.
Sounds like you need another factor in the equation. Amount of addressable galaxy.
Oh, amount of addressable galaxy. Yeah, that I think ties into both the communication and the lifetime questions. Yes? How would you recognize the signal as numbers? Yes. Oh, so you could imagine, there's those stars that are like lighthouses, so it's like a pulse. And it's a pulse every, depends on the star, every millisecond or every 12 seconds. You can imagine someone wanting to make contact would send a signal that's not a regular pulse, but they would be like, one, da, 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 da. The next prime number is three, two. You could count in that way. There's a really great movie, show of hands, who has seen the movie Contact? Or read the book?
Book's great.
It was written by Carl Sagan, an astronomer who was heavily involved in SETI research. That movie is a huge part of the reason of why I became an astronomer, because I was 13. In that movie, it's a really great movie to watch because Carl Sagan puts a lot of those realistic elements where, they catch one boop and then two and then three, and I think they do prime numbers up to like 101 or something. Yeah, so it's hard because one thing we haven't talked about yet is how do you communicate between species that have evolved on completely different planets? Like, we can't even communicate multiculturally among one species. Good point in that And as you were talking about science being empirical before, something that I've been thinking a lot more than I did as a student and wish I had more, is how dependent science is on the observer and how dependent the science we do is on the humans that are making the decisions about what questions to tackle and how, with what technology, with what frequencies, like you said.
But if you mean frequency Accents. Literally, I thought scientists thought...
If you mean frequency literally.
I thought that scientists have thought very long and hard about which frequencies to focus on. So there are certain ones they think are more likely to be the kind that an alien civilization would broadcast on. So I don't know. You can tell
sure,
us. But it's not just random. They listen to certain wavelengths.
So
which
can,
ones?
Yeah, so you can think of the frequency in this sense as being like tuning your radio dial. Like, I don't know how many of you guys... Okay, we all have digital stuff now. But... I'm old enough to remember turning a dial on a radio to hit a particular frequency. There's a huge radio spectrum out there, and the question is, where do you look? That's one of the problems, right? If you've got a huge spectrum, on what frequencies do we look? Because we don't have the technology to scan them all the time. Scientists have zeroed in on a few, like 1.4 gigahertz is the frequency at which neutral hydrogen atoms give off radiation. It's fantastic. We see hydrogen everywhere. We see it in the Milky Way. We see it in other galaxies. It's the most common element in the universe. So assuming that, well, if hydrogen gives off that one particular frequency, radio astronomers and other civilizations are going to be using that frequency to study the hydrogen. If some civilization wants to be heard, they will transmit with that particular frequency in order to be heard. Again, that's something very deliberate. That is in fact a protected band here. No one is allowed to transmit at that frequency because it's so important for astronomers. It's like the one tiny little sliver slice that we get all to ourselves.
That's the only one?
Basically.
So SETI, so SETI scientists are only listening to that one bandwidth or one frequency, whatever the word is?
Not necessarily. They're looking at a bunch of different frequencies, but we build radio telescopes in the middle of nowhere because everything else we have gives off radio frequencies. So we have to rule out human sources of radio frequencies in order to do that work. For radio astronomy, we go to places like South Africa or West Virginia, where there are actually laws restricting radio emissions in that little spot in West Virginia. They can search anywhere, it's just harder.
So do we all know what SETI is? What does SETI stand for? It's an acronym. What is S-E-T-I?
Search
for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, right? So is there any government money spent on this?
Yes. Actually, there's no long, not the case anymore. There was a proposed project that was shot down in the 90s. There's a podcast put out by the SETI Institute. SETI Institute is a private organization that carries out that search. They did a really great show on their podcast called Big Picture Science, where they talk about like the death of government-funded SETI. There was a particular congressperson that was, you know, wanted to show that they were, you know, cutting wasteful spending and decided ET was wasteful spending. And so it's not popular enough to get any sort of federal funding. But it's often funded by a couple things. It's either funded privately, or you can take radio astronomy observations that are funded by public money and search through them anyway.
So I'm curious what you think. So do you think that the government should spend our tax dollars on searching for extraterrestrial intelligence? There are real problems in the world. People are starving to death, and people are shooting each other or whatever. So should we spend money looking for aliens? What do you think? I mean, you're all here tonight, so I assume you have some interest in extraterrestrial intelligence. So I would think that we're not a totally unbiased audience. But what do you think? I assume that you are very pro SETI. You think the government should spend money on this?
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
You haven't thought about it?
I am super, super, super pro spending money on basic science because you never know what's going to come out of it. Whether or not that include SETI? I don't know. If it was my money, hell yeah, I'd throw my money into it. I don't feel in the position to make that. I'm way down here in the hierarchy.
No.
So the question is...
You mean like an Area 51?
Well, that, yeah.
Why spend the money if they already have the evidence and they haven't disclosed it? I actually spent a long, long time being super into researching UFO sightings and things like that, and I got frustrated because I couldn't find evidence that convinced me. And then later on, I realized that astronomers are the worst gossips in the entire world. I'm a little skeptical that the scientific community could be bribed into silence on that. So that is a possibility. It's not completely ruled out, but I see it as highly unlikely. But that would be, yeah, why spend money if we already have a craft in the bottom?
But suppose they don't have a craft, so maybe they do. If they don't, then should we be spending our money doing this? So why are you all here? I assume that you're interested in aliens, so you must think that it's important, right? Or, I mean, we should be investigating it, and if we discovered aliens tomorrow, that would be a big deal, or not. So we just want to know about everything, and aliens happen to be one thing that we could know about, so why not? Snails, aliens,
yeah.
We like to know things, yeah?
Is there something special about aliens?
Yes.
That I do not know. Again, it's a private organization, so I don't know that much about their spending.
Do you know about how many researchers?
It's tough, because a lot of the researchers will do a little bit of SETI and a little bit of other projects. There's a few people who are like full-time, like Jill Tarter, like Seth Shostak. Those are two very prominent scientists who work at the SETI Institute. But when I go to astronomy conferences, I run across lots of people who use the Allen Telescope Array, which was built and funded to do SETI, but they're using it for all kinds of other radio astronomy projects and technology development projects. So I think it's kind of hard to say how many. So talking about looking for like these historical artifacts,
yeah,
or evidence from the past.
Charlie Mann wrote a book in 1491.
So I'm aware of a lot of the kind of the ancient alien type stuff. And as far as spans in time, that's still not a big span in time.
The audience might not be.
So that's a span in time that's still on the order of a couple thousand years, when this lifetime gap could be more like 500 million years. And that's another area where, again, I haven't been super convinced by all of the evidence that I've seen into it, but that would be one thing to look for, not just on Earth, but everywhere else we go. Because if there was another civilization, and if they traveled, what artifacts would be left behind in our own neighborhood? That is something.
But I guess one thing, I feel like, I mean, not that the burden's on you, but no one has given me a reason to think that we should care even then. So suppose we discover that there were ancient aliens. I mean, how is that different from discovering that, tomorrow that there's a signal from Alpha Centauri with the prime numbers? So why should I care if there are aliens. Maybe if you like snails, that's great. If you like aliens, that's great. But why should people in general care about extraterrestrial intelligence? How does it affect our lives at all? No, right, fine. Yes. If there's an alien coming into my bedroom every night, I would like to know that. That's
so, true. So there's another great Carl Sagan book, as you can tell I'm a bit of a fangirl. Demon Haunted World is a book that he wrote, I don't remember when, 80s? And he talks very specifically about alien abductee stories and the fact that, like, gee, if this is happening every day, this is something we should care about. And that is another ethical issue, I think, that comes into this play.
Yeah, there are aliens coming into my bedroom every night. That would be assaulting me. Yeah, that's an ethical issue.
What is, why do we care? I think most of us here probably think aliens are more interesting than snails. Sorry, snails. Why do we care so much about aliens and searching for them? And I would say not just intelligent aliens. I would lose my mind if we found, like, single-cell organisms. Bacteria, right?
Yeah.
I think the words you use make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And when I hear alien, I don't want to offend anybody, my mind goes to one area. But when I hear life outside of Earth, now I'm interested. I do care about that very much.
So that life outside of Earth and extraterrestrial intelligence are very long. And so it's easier just to say alien.
But you're right, there's a connotation.
But when you hear alien, why can't you just think like life outside of Earth?
It's probably my fault.
No. It's not your fault. You're okay. Okay, fine. So,
alien makes me cringe.
Alien. The word alien makes you cringe?
Yeah, it does. And life, that's really exciting.
Okay, you're absolutely right. So I'm big in science communication. I think you hit the nail on the head. It absolutely matters how we talk about things, which again goes back to
why would it matter? I don't understand. So, I mean, if we were in France, we'd be using a French word, and so who cares what word we use as long as we define our terms. So by alien, henceforth, alien will mean life that emerged on some planet other than Earth.
But there's a cultural context of the word alien where we see little green men, little gray beams versus life. I imagine like blooming trees and flowers. It would take a long time to change your, get your brain to think of it the other way. Civilizations advanced enough to have faster than light communication, like a Star Trek. I forget what they do, some mumble jumble science words. I mean, warp technology is how they travel, I forget how they communicate. Yeah, so.
Space communication?
As far as we know, light is the thing that travels the fastest, and if we communicate at the speed of light, it would take decades to centuries to millennia to have a conversation. So, what difference would that make? And I always go back to the time scale, because if a civilization has been around long enough, 50 million, not even 50 million, give them like 500,000 years, right? Way more than us. How much more technologically advanced could they be? How much more can they understand the universe in order to make that happen? But that makes it tricky in another way, because that means if that has happened, so there should be signals all over the place. Right?
And aren't you strongly inclined to say that nothing can travel faster than light? I mean, aren't you sort of commit? Okay, right. So even though obviously you're open to other possibilities, but still you think it's very unlikely at this point.
As someone who speaks at sci-fi conventions, I do like to explore the possibilities. I'm not super convinced that.
Right. So some might say, look, here's why we should care if extraterrestrial intelligent creatures exist on their planets, because they could teach us a lot, right? They could solve our political problems. They could give us technology so that we could, avoid the global warming catastrophe and provide food for everyone. One impediment to that is that, look, if this galaxy is 25 light years away, by the time we respond, by the time they get a response with our questions, we'll all be dead. So this is one reason to think that, who cares? I mean, so we get a signal tomorrow from a planet that's 25 light years away, we respond immediately, and by the time we could ever hope to hear back from them, I would be dead. I don't see why we should care at all about aliens. Oh, sorry.
Convince him
otherwise. Extraterrestrial intelligent creatures.
He doesn't care. Convince him otherwise.
Yeah. I don't see why you're all here. Okay.
So I can't speak for the scientific community as a whole, putting that out there. However, my background as someone who is super, super, super into UFOs and super, super, super into astronomy from a young, both of those from a young age, there are lots of sightings. When you start to dig into the nature of the sightings, most of them can be explained by natural phenomena. And I will give you this one anecdote. I was in graduate school, and we were observing at the observatory. We're out on the catwalk very late at night, and we see this light like blinking and changing color and like hovering. And I was just like, oh my God, finally I get to see. And I showed my friends, and they're all like, whoa. And it took us a few minutes, several astronomy PhD candidates, to figure out it was Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky. Because it was so low in the atmosphere, it makes it do all kinds of weird things. So most of the sightings can be explained in that way. There's a small percentage that can't. They haven't presented enough evidence to show that, like, yes, this was something of an extraterrestrial origin. This was something unnatural, not from this Earth.
I thought a class where we address some of these issues, and even though it's more psychology than philosophy, I did anyway. And we know things like, you know, human beings are prone to see things that aren't there, and we have bad memory, as I mentioned before. People think people have vivid memories of the Challenger exploding, and we know that most of the memories are actually inaccurate. So human beings see things that aren't there, we have very inaccurate memories, you know, we are prone to make all kinds of false beliefs, things we see things we want to be there, and so on. So when you look at these cases, most of them can be explained through psychology, not all of them, but then you have this sort of residuum left over, and then what does that amount to? That's true.
That's true. No, or hard to explain because you don't have enough data, is what it often turns out to be. Can you then pin it on one of the most extreme possibilities? Are you comfortable doing that? Are we comfortable doing that? I, in addition to growing up on Contact, I grew up on the X-Files, and I want to believe, and I have the poster. Any other X-Files fans here? Yay, thank you, somebody! I haven't, like I said, I want to believe, but haven't been convinced yet. And Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan, he actually takes that question pretty seriously and talks about that in more detail, in terms of both UFO sightings and alien abduction experiences. Not enough evidence means, in many cases, you have an eyewitness report, but not a lot of detail. And I get this on Twitter all the time. I saw this thing, it was in the sky, what is it? If you give me a position and a time, I can help you out. Very often, a lot of them actually come through very vaguely. That is the kind of thing you're looking for. Something that, or some kind of knowledge being imparted that we didn't know before would be evidence. I won't spoil it, but the end of Contact the Book would be evidence.
Well, isn't the problem that you have just this one individual who is just their you know, their report, and so they don't have an implant to show us. They don't have anything that we can actually verify. They just have, it's their word. And so, and if we can't explain it by something we knew was in the sky that night, yeah, they saw it, and maybe they did. But then how do you, what do I do? How do I prove that, you know? When I teach out, I talked about ghosts in one of my classes, because I talk about the afterlife. And one argument for the afterlife is that people see ghosts, and the best explanation that ghosts are, you know, the souls of dead people. Almost, you know, I have dozens of students who have ghost stories to tell. Sometimes I can explain them away, but not always. But then what do you do with that? I wasn't there. I mean, so yeah, maybe they say a ghost, maybe not. Am I convinced that they're a ghost because my students have ghost stories to tell? I mean, no. If it happened to me, maybe it would convince me, but I don't know. It's hard. When it's one individual who has a story to tell, and I can't explain it away, am I supposed to then shift my whole worldview to align with that? I don't know.
I'm encouraged that there are people paying attention to it. I've been disappointed. I've been sorely disappointed. And one thing you can compare specifically UFO sightings to is the sightings of fireballs and meteors from large rocks burning up in the atmosphere. Over the last 10 whatever years or so, we've all ended up with these cameras in our pockets and can take pictures of everything. The number of recorded sightings of meteors and fireballs has dramatically increased. The number of pictures of things that people think are alien craft have not, or have dropped off. That kind of also rings a bell for me, like, okay, why is that, you know, if everybody's taking pictures of the weird stuff they see, why has that been so elusive?
I think it's worth paying attention to also. But unless I'm going to be abducted, or they're actually going to invade America and try to eat us all, then why should I care? So there are these teenagers from Alpha Centauri. They fly around and they buzz some kids in a cornfield and fly off. As long as they're not going to eat me, why should I care? So tomorrow we get a signal. And that's what you would expect, right? See the prime numbers. So we know there's an intelligent race of aliens out there, 25 light years away. We'll never talk to them about politics while I'm alive. You already believe in aliens, don't you? Aren't you convinced that there probably are aliens out there? So then, how would your worldview change if suddenly tomorrow you knew that there was evidence for aliens? I'm sorry, extraterrestrial intelligent creatures.
So in terms of belief of aliens, again, I don't want to put my foot on the scale one way or the other.
Oh, I think there are probably
aliens. I'm, based on what I know, I think it's super, super likely that there's extraterrestrials somewhere.
Oh,
I think it's super, super likely.
Doesn't that make you believe it?
We're going to find bacteria. I don't know.
How can you think something super, super likely but not believe it?
Because I can't make conclusions from it.
I have all kinds of beliefs that I'm not certain of, right?
So if we have evidence of one particular planet where life arose and evolved, and that's a sample size of one. The fact that it originated here, we know. If there's a second example, to go from one to two and be able to detect that in our tiny corner of the universe, that would shift my thinking, because then I would believe it to be so much more likely.
There are people who do believe in extraterrestrial intelligence out there, and so what matters if we get evidence of that? It's one thing if you don't believe it. If you're, you know, you think you're a really hardcore Christian who thinks that God created life in just one planet, there's just us, we're special, and then suddenly there are aliens, yeah, that's like, well, that's like your worldview shaken up for 24 hours. But if you already believe it, then what is the evidence at?
Wouldn't it be nice to know that, that they were coming, if they were coming to blow us up, so we can prepare?
It's a great question. If you were going to die tomorrow, would you want to know? I guess so, because then you wouldn't do any schoolwork today, and you would, you know, you would like eat lots of ice cream, and you would stay up late. Yeah, so I want to know if I could live it up. Yeah, I guess, yeah, that's good. I guess I'm imagining the most likely scenario is that SETI discovers a signal, and the signal is very far away, and the signal is like a mathematical signal that has no real content, just that this is not random, this is from an intelligent race of creatures. I believe that there actually are probably intelligent creatures out there, so I'm not a scientist, but I think, yeah, it's a really big, there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and there are 100 billion galaxies in our universe, and that's a lot. And I think, yeah, it's very likely that there are other creatures out there who are intelligent. I don't see how it makes a difference. It's one thing if they send me a formula for cold fusion or something really cool, but if it's just the mere knowledge of their existence, I already believe in them, so who cares?
So I have a counterpoint, but I want to see what you folks have to say first.
Well, if you assume they may be more advanced than us, and they may be traveling, I mean we're traveling, then you're making the assumption that they're far away and they can't get here, mm-hmm. and that our communication is with them far away. Well, maybe they originated far away, but if we're assuming they're more advanced than us and they're traveling, then who's to say we aren't communicating with some of them while they're traveling and they're not so far away?
That I think is actually more likely. If they've, because the, back to the time argument, if an alien, if alien civilizations pop up randomly, right? They're not all gonna show up at one time, like in Star Trek, like they all get, they're all at the same, roughly same technological level at the same time. That's super unlikely. So if there's another one out there, chances are it's been around so long that it's figured out interstellar travel. So yeah, I think it would be super likely that we'd come across them that way rather than a radio signal, which I think brings us back to the blowing up planet question.
No, and of course, obviously, if the way we discover aliens is that they're here and they're here to eat us, I would be really obsessed. But that's sort of shifting the question. My question is, look, if we only know that we're not alone in the universe, does that matter? And we can change the question to, well, and they're going to eat you if they exist, or they're going to invade you if they exist. Yeah, then that obviously matters. I'm wondering, if you knew that there were other intelligent creatures out there, and they posed no direct threat to us, why would that matter? That's the question. And so we can change the question to, should we worry about it? And I guess that's a good question. And I'm not worried, but I wasn't before. And now I'm a little more worried because of this group right there.
Yeah, bunch of hands.
I think we're sitting on an extremely prime piece of real estate here.
Prime piece of real estate.
So I don't think anyone's going to want to blow us up, but they might want to replace us or use us as a farm. So I think there are risks. I don't think someone's going to blow up our planet. It's just too perfect a planet.
Blowing us up first, blowing
we'll
us planet.
We'll just
blow
it ourselves first.
Yeah. So saying that this is a prime piece of real estate, they may want it.
Yeah.
And to kick us out.
And this is actually an argument to not transmit signals, right? So there's this question of, should we be transmitting?
When we think of aliens, we think of people who kind of have the same needs as people. And I think aliens are kind of a
great point. The point is that how likely is it that these other aliens will have the same needs and requirements that would make this a prime piece of real estate. I alluded to this earlier. We have to make assumptions when we start looking or trying to narrow our search space. So we pick life like us, carbon-based maybe, water-based maybe, but there are other possibilities out there which may be not as likely for various reasons involving a periodic table that I don't have in front of me to point at, but there's a thinking process that one of Saturn's moons, Titan, has methane and ethane. It's like a big freaking ball of gasoline in set on fire. But that could have a type of life form that has a completely different chemical cycle, which would mean how would we even interact with that? Is what I think.
Well, also they wouldn't want to invade us, right? Because we would be poisonous to them.
Hopefully.
Do you have a question?
I just think you're underestimating the nature of human curiosity, that we just want to know. And you want me to justify why I want to know. And all I can say to you back is that I want to know. My answer to your question would be because.
Fine. And I agree. As a philosophy professor, I have lots of questions, and I love asking questions and learning new things. But it seems like extraterrestrial intelligent creatures hold a special kind of fascination for people, and they seem to think that getting a sign from another planet would be something way more profound than just learning something new about the periodic table. So I guess I agree with you. I also am curious. Should we have a special curiosity for this possibility? Is SETI somehow is it special? Is it that more interesting than snails? Does the existence of life on other planets, is that somehow more interesting or significant than a new kind of snail?
Well, it would change our paradigm quite a bit.
How? But why? I already believe in life on the planet.
People don't believe in the literal truth of the Bible. Would be confronted with something that they're not prepared to deal with.
The Christian community would handle this in 24 hours.
So would that prove life is found on other planets? I mean, it could prove that if God seeded life here, that God could have seeded life in a thousand places.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I have a tiny little thing I want to interject here. In the history of the beliefs of extraterrestrial intelligence, at one point it was just basically accepted that other planets had life forms, and there was an actual theological debate about whether there was one savior for all of them or if each planet had their own savior. Go ahead.
About why is it important when people recognize it and celebrate it or something? Mm. What did landing on the moon do? How did it impact?
Improved to the... It showed that we won the Cold War, I think.
So her point was that, and this is great. The 50-year anniversary, right? Humans landed on the moon. That had a huge impact in that moment in time. But as you're pointing out, it doesn't seem to have made a long-term impact. And as someone who was born after the Apollo program, I'm super annoyed that we don't have people like on the moon all the time. It didn't make that long-term change. Yeah, would this be like in the news cycle for a while and then fade.
What do you guys think about the alternative explanation for the UFO phenomena that people report? There's a whole school of thought that the UFOs are actually interdimensional beings traveling to our dimension in and out. Mm-hmm. And they pop into existence, and you see a UFO moving, and all of a sudden it's gone, and it pops up over here.
Well, no, that, to me that's actually, I think, more of a scientific question. So, I mean, to me that's like, well, what's the evidence for it? And so the evidence that we use in philosophy classes is arguments. So can you give me an argument that God exists,
well,
that we have a soul?
I can't, but what I understand from other people who are more expert than me by far in this is that there's talk about these demons or whatever you want to call them in virtually every religion around the world for thousands of years. All different languages, all different places in the world are reports of these beings, let's call them, that are not earthlings, not people.
So are you asking me if I believe in demons?
We've got a couple things here. So one of them is the hypothesis that UFOs or other sightings like that are due to something that's not spatial in terms of like coming from another solar system, but interdimensional. And that is tricky because we don't have any good scientific idea of what that other dimension would be like, right? So it's kind of just opening up another whole bunch of questions. And then your other point is that we've had this long history of, in, like you said, almost every culture, almost every language, these unnatural or supernatural beings. Is there some common thread to it? And I would also say, well, could the common thread be our human brains? And something, is it a common experience, or is it something that is coming from something intrinsic about us? Again, I don't think I have an answer for that. What?
I think I vote for that.
You vote for that one?
Intrinsic,
that there's something for us? It could be that. So, again, it's sample size one. We're one species. We have a lot in common. Maybe that is behind that, too. Yellow, yeah.
Well, what the gentleman in front of me mentioned just now and earlier, but back to UFOs, I just find the recent in the news, I find it very compelling, the pilots, the Navy pilots, what they're seeing. I mean, I'm not really impressed by comets or whatever things that people think they see, pipelines, but these pilots seem pretty experienced, and there's numerous evidence, it seems, of them, and but they're seeing things that are moving in a way that we don't have the technology for. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about other countries' military, they're probably not sharing. To me, that just seems really compelling and not something that can be explained away. I mean, I don't know for sure, of course, but mm-hmm. it can't be explained away by, you know, the atmosphere or something. It just, I find it very interesting.
So the question is the particularly recent uptick of reports by pilots.
Yes.
And the consideration that they are experts in that way. So they are experts in aircraft. I don't know to what extent that expertise includes aerial phenomena, right? So there's lots of aerial phenomena, stellar phenomena, visual phenomena that being a pilot doesn't prepare you for, and they're still subject to the same biases and I can't think of the word, just visual, I don't know, our brains doing things. What?
Illusions.
Illusions, yes. As
cognitive distortions.
Cognitive distortion, great, thank you. So I do, you know, again, you do want to pay attention to that, but just, you know, having some kind of expertise, and I'm saying this as someone who's supposed to be an expert, don't mean a whole lot. If I said I saw one, I don't think anyone should listen to me.
So I have students who believe in ghosts because they tell me these stories, and the stories are, well, like they see something out of the corner of their eye for half a second at night. And it's never a group of people who are sitting around and they talk to a ghost for half an hour, and the ghost leaves behind a bunch of stuff that wouldn't be there if the ghost didn't exist. It's always these, like, if there are ghosts that really come back to us, why do they only appear to individuals at night for half a second? I mean, it seems like that's very strange, if that's how it works. And so, to me, it seems like, well, if there are UFOs that are really flying around, why is it only Navy pilots for half a second while they're flying in these aircraft?
Isn't that a logical fallacy?
What's that?
Isn't it a logical fallacy to equate ghost sightings with
It's an analogy. I mean, that's not a fallacy. It's just an analogy. I mean, there are false analogies, but I'm trying to... So, if I don't mean it to be like a proof. It's just, I'm just saying, you know, here's a similar phenomena, and here's what I think of it, so that, and obviously the same sort of thing applies to...
In terms of visual phenomena, there's a link, yeah.
And why don't they just come down and land and show us themselves? So, here's another analogy, if I may. I know people who believe in that God heals people, okay? And so that they believe in healings, prayer healings. And the kinds of healings there are always things like back pain or sinus infection or things like that. It's never like a limb grows back or somebody who didn't have an eyeball as an eyeball again. It's always just things that can they're kind of vague and kind of can probably be explained naturally. So if there are all these sightings, why are they all things like a radar blip or one guy sees out of the corner of his eye? Why don't they come down to a group of 10 people for 5 minutes?
Oh, perfect. So we want to communicate with the aliens. What makes us think they want to communicate with us and let us know about their existence? So what do you think on that? I have an answer, but I'm going to throw it to you first.
Why me first? I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
I guess the
claim is that there's evidence for aliens, actually the alien word, because of all these sightings. So obviously they must not mind being seen, right? Because they let themselves be seen all the time. And if they do make some mistakes, why not bigger mistakes? Where it's then 5 people instead of 1 person. And in broad daylight instead of just at night, right? So that's
actually a strong possibility. And one thing we didn't even have time to get to because we've so many awesome things to talk about. One of the physicists of the 1950s did some calculations and determined that, you know, well, we should have seen aliens by now. This is Enrico Fermi. And one of the solutions to this paradox is that, yeah, they're here, they're all around us, they're being really, really secretive. I tie all of these things to science fiction because that is also one of my loves. In Star Trek, the Prime Directive makes it such that you can't interfere with the evolution of a species that hasn't gotten to warp capability yet, I think. So,
So
if there's warp capable civilization that has a prime directive that says we can't interfere with those little grubby, you know, meat things that still use gas, you know, fossils as fuel, that would be one big way in which that they'd be hidden from us. Like you said, maybe they'd get seen accidentally. My argument against that, being a Star Trek fan, is Captain Kirk. How many times has he violated the Prime Directive? Like, there has to be no Kirks in an entire alien civilization for that to be the case.
Yeah,
but that is, you know, that's a possibility, is why
yeah.
reveal their existence.
Go ahead.
I'm a big skeptic of this whole topic, but I also, too, was impressed by those sightings, by those Navy pilots. And I thought, gee, that's very interesting. But I think it's very natural tendency for human beings to want to fill in the blank. And for some reason, I'm comfortable saying, I can't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it means. Let's see. And wait for something resembling what I would call evidence to appear. I think it's, you don't go very far if you added an answer that isn't correct. So just the way I've dealt with that is I've said, gee, that's very interesting. Those are very reliable people, well trained, mm-hmm. know how to be good observers. They saw something they didn't understand. Isn't that interesting? Stop. I just stop right there and say, I don't know. And I'm comfortable with that.
One of the hardest things about being a scientist, training to be a scientist, was learning to be uncomfortable with uncertainty. And knowing that you have, you know, some data or some observations that you just can't explain, or that you just can't understand, and that no one understands or can explain. It's a little uncomfortable, but it's an okay place to be, to say that, yeah, there's these weird sightings, I don't know what it means, if I'm not convinced that it's one particular explanation or another.
Go ahead.
I think there's a third possible explanation for the phenomena that's seen now. Certainly not 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, but it's been 74 years since the Hiroshima bomb. It's a lot of time for technology to advance. And I think it's pretty generally accepted that at least the United States government and probably some other major governments have huge black programs in which they develop secret technologies. So a lot of the stuff that's seen could very well be coming from our own secret developments or others.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the rise in UFO reports went along with the rise in fear and paranoia from the Cold War. And in that case, and in the rise of aerospace technology as well.
I saw something, I just remembered this, counteracting the whole idea of UFOs, and they showed pictures from the 1950s or 1940s on of UFO sightings,
mm-hmm.
drawings and photographs, and they all looked like the technology of the era.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Yes. When you look at the history of the descriptions of the aliens themselves, they were very human-like until the Betty and Barney Hill case, I forget when that was, and that stamped a particular image in everyone's minds, and then every alien case after that had that image. Yeah, you can see these patterns in the observations, and like you said, it seemed to match the technology of the time.
Sorry to single you all, maybe you don't want to be called on. But calling on you. So if we discover tomorrow that there were extraterrestrial intelligences out there, would that be, I don't know, do you think that was profound? Would that interest you?
If there is, they landed on the moon, and we'll be able to find their footprints, and we should keep track of the footprints we made. Because if all this flying saucer stuff is true, let's face it, they landed on Mars, they landed on the moon, they had to leave footprints in the dust.
Yeah.
And we're going to find it when we explore the moon. And I don't believe we're going to find anything there. Another thing, all these sightings we were seeing in the 60s, well, Pease Air Base, they were experimenting because we were in the Cold War. That's why they established Pease Air Base in the first place anyway. And they were experimenting in the early 60s with a hovercraft, and it would just hover. And, you know, the incident at Exeter and Barney Hill, and they go out at night because they didn't want people to see it from the fire tower on Stratton Hill, because you can see the air base from the fire tower in Stratton. So they'd go out at night, and people were seeing all this stuff, and it was Pease Air Base with a hovercraft.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
thank you all for coming.
The history of military technology is a whole other fascinating topic.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing I like more than to completely exhaust everyone's brains for an hour and a half. So
yay.
That was epic.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you for coming. Great audience. Thank you.